It's time to begin our study in Revelation. We are nearing the end. And I don't know if any fatigue has set in for anyone, but we've been studying this book for a long time, and honestly, a lot has been left unsaid that could have been said about the book. But we are near the end. Just kind of as an introduction to this last section, and really, to me, chapters 21 and 22... the chapter break again is somewhat unfortunate. I think the scene is continuous. So really, there's one more point I think to be made by the author of the book of Revelation, and then there's kind of the closing section, and that probably would have been a more logical way to divide the book. But anyways, so where are we in Revelation? I mean, as far as the description of things, kind of, how do things stand as we open chapter 21 of Revelation? Okay, and that's kind of where I'm going with that. What's the situation? As we open this scene and this new vision is being shown to John, and as these visions have played out and kind of this message has been delivered, Where do things stand? What sequence of events have just come through, and kind of what is the situation? It's the victory of God's people. And I understand with the language that it sounds very much like the final judgment, but I have a problem with taking the last three chapters of Revelation and jumping to the end of all times, because in chapter 1 and chapter 22, the point is made repeatedly that these things must shortly come to pass. It's been 2,000 years, and we're still here. So applying, and that's really going to influence my take on the chapters that we're going to discuss here at the end of the book, is because all along Revelation has been about the immediate context of when the book was written. The first century, the persecution, the conflict between Rome and God's people. And then to many people, many commentators even, at chapter 20, because of the language and because of the imagery, jump to the final judgment. And I just think that's inconsistent. And I don't think you have to do that to get the point. Now, a lot of the images shown are consistent with things that are taught about how things are going to end for this world. You know, other places it talks about this earth being reserved for fire and this earth passing away and being a new city and a city where the people of God will dwell and he will dwell. Those are all true. I'm just saying that I don't think that's what this context is discussing. Because we've said all along, and we tell our friends that read this with a premillennialist viewpoint, that, well, how can you say that this hasn't happened and this hasn't, the fifth trumpet, how can you say that? Because the book says these things must shortly come to pass. And then we ourselves get to the end of the book and say, oh, this is the final judgment. It's like, Do you at least see where I'm coming from with that? To remain consistent with our interpretation of the book. So in the last few scenes, what we've seen the defeat of the beasts, the land beasts and the sea beasts. Where are they? By the opening of chapter 21, where are the beasts? In the lake of fire. We've seen the chaining of the dragon, the seizing of the dragon and being bound and put away in the abyss. Where's the dragon now as this chapter opens? In the lake of fire. We saw at the end of chapter 19 the followers of the beasts. What happened to them? They were scattered and killed. And then in chapter 20, at the end of chapter 20, we have the judgment scene where anyone whose name was not found where? Written in the book of life. Where are they? Lake of fire. So, you know, we've kind of spent the last, and there was some of the contrast that we keep coming back to in the book of Revelation. You know, choose the dragon, choose the beast, mark of the beast, all those things we've talked about. You can choose that way, and this is the outcome, or you can choose God, you can choose to be a follower of the Lamb, you can choose to receive the mark. We've seen many ways of that being described. But Revelation is fundamentally a book about choosing between the world and God, and the outcome of those choices. Can anybody, by the end of this book, claim, oh, I didn't realize if I did this or chose that way, I didn't realize what that was going to mean for me or where I was going to end up by the end of this book. It's been We've spent, what now, almost 26 weeks. Actually, it's been 26 weeks because we're a couple weeks behind. Looking at scene after scene after scene where, you know, the two witnesses are slain by the beast, but then they're resurrected and the people that their enemies were devoured by fire. We've seen the Satan being released from the abyss and gathering Gog and Magog, and it looks like the sands of the seashore, and it's just overwhelming, and yet they're devoured. I mean, over and over and over, we've seen the 144,000 on the mountain with the Lamb. We've seen the multitude celebrating around the throne. I mean, just scene after scene after scene after scene. You cannot read this book and come away thinking that there's more than two sides, can you? Because, and even that is addressed. I mean, in chapter 18, you know, the beast was slain and the scarlet woman was devoured by the king. But who else was mourning and weeping and suffering because of that? The kings that had allied themselves with it, and the merchants, and even the sailors. You know, people said, well, look, I wasn't the one that was instigating, but they went along with it. They allied themselves with it. And they ended up suffering the same fate as the beast. It's a book about picking a side. And I've probably said that enough that y'all are sick of hearing it. Pick a side. But that's what, to me, fundamentally, that's what Revelation is about. And the last three chapters, two chapters, have kind of been focused on what happens if you pick this side. You know, with the destruction of the beast, the lake of fire, even death and Hades have been cast into the lake of fire. Now I think the rest of the book turns back to this is what happens when you pick God's side. And I think what's being described with these images here are, I think in Jim's note, he says the triumphant church. I think what's being depicted here is the church on the other side of this conflict with Rome. You know, because while this book is a book about making a choice, it's also a book of encouragement to make the right choice and to be confident in the choice of choosing God. And that's what I think the next two chapters are about. I mean, and yes, this imagery is used elsewhere to talk about heaven. And yes, ultimately, that is the consequence, capital C, of choosing God. But I think to remain faithful to our approach to Revelation, we need to view this as the church having come through, the victorious church, the victorious faithful of God. And we've said that before about the 144,000. Those who came through the tribulation, we said we don't have to jump to the rapture and the tribulation and the thousand-year reign. It's enough to say these are the people who came through the persecution with their faith intact. So I'm saying this is just another way of depicting that same group of people. This is God's faithful, who despite Satan's best efforts, despite Rome's best efforts, are still standing when the dust settles. Okay, does anybody have any problem with that or questions about that? Or I mean, do you at least see what I mean about being consistent in applying these images in that way? Yeah, and that's a good point. And I've, you know, there are movies and stuff that kind of take that approach. You know, as the movie is coming on, you know, I'm thinking the Marvel movies, you know, and there's all these scenes from these different movies, and it's just like they're over here and over here and over here and over here, and it gives you an overall picture. But it's not this is going to happen and this is going to happen, this is going to happen. And that's the way the whole book has kind of been. And I think that's here, Don is seeing, you know, to put a technological, you know, it's like a screen and there's all these screens and he's seeing all these different things. But I think the overall or the theme of all these scenes is the church, God's people, are victorious. Especially in contrast when you look at how the last chapter closed, the scene that just ended was the judgment of the dead. And in the book of Revelation, the dead usually refers to who? Not those who have lost their lives, but yeah, the rebellious. And we've seen the judgment of the dead and the very stark statement, verse 5, anyone whose name was not found written in the book of life was thrown into the lake of fire. You know, we understand from the rest of the New Testament that is the ultimate fate of those who choose not to put their faith in God. So I'm not disputing, but I'm just saying it here that I don't think that's what's in view. But yeah, we understand that rebelling against God has consequences in this life, right? Does anybody dispute that? I mean, living a life in rebellion to God has its own consequences here. And then, again, the consequence, capital C, is your eternal fate. Okay, so with that being said, I'm going to look at these images as applying to the triumphant church, the church that is still standing when Rome's efforts to defeat it, when Satan's efforts to destroy it through Rome have failed. Because I think that's where we are in the imagery. Gail, comment?
You see these chapters as looking at those that are faithful who have died in the Lord, all inclusive of the earth, the church on the earth, as well as those that have died and gone, or do you make any distinction?
I don't make a distinction. I do think the immediate context is this is being written to people who have probably seen loved ones die, have seen brothers and sisters in Christ put to death, because we know from history that that happened. So in the immediate context, what's being described here, and we've seen this even in chapter 20, the ones that, who are participating in the first resurrection and reigning with Christ for the 1,000 years, it says those who, how did it say, had been beheaded because of the testimony of Jesus. I don't think that means that only those who were beheaded and those who were burned were not, but it's the idea of those who gave up their lives have won. But I think the message there also to the Christians of the first century who are still alive is that the church will persist. The church will endure. God's people will be saved, will win this fight. And remember, this is written, if we're right about our date, around 90, 95 AD, at the beginning of this. This persecution went on for a couple of hundred years. So the people who first read this book died without seeing that victory. But in Hebrews 11, the writer talks about those who died looking for things, looking for promises that they didn't see in their lifetime. But that didn't mean that the promises weren't true. And they never doubted that the promises were true. And it actually says in that text, which I think has some parallels with our text today, God is not ashamed to be called their God and has prepared a city to dwell with them among them because they were, even though they didn't actually live to see the fulfillment, or at least they didn't live on this earth to see the fulfillment. So to answer your question, I don't make a distinction between those who have actually given up their lives and the faithful as a whole. And like so much else of the Bible, the immediate the book has an immediate context, but there are principles in here that extend to all God's people throughout the ages. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I see it as it's talking basically about on the other side of death. If I lived in 95 and hadn't died, this is the outcome. Here's what the overcomer gets.
And okay.
So I see that victory, but I would go ahead and extend that. Well, that's what eternity is like as well, because we're in the presence of God. And I think the victorious church is a good way to describe these chapters, but that victorious church is victorious for eternity. Considerations, and so I blend those in my mind together.
Okay.
That's just fine.
Okay, and again, better, more intelligent, more studious people than me are not dogmatic about this, so I'm certainly not going to be. And I absolutely agree that these descriptions can apply to the church in heaven as well. But I keep coming back to these things must shortly come to pass. To take the immediate context, but I don't. I you can take these descriptions and apply them to the triumphant church at the end of time, and it fits. And I think a lot of and I think Jim makes the note or makes the observation that a lot of the songs we sing about heaven draw their imagery from these two chapters, and that's fine. That's fine because the idea of being with God, the barrier being removed, there's no temple anymore because the people are the temple and God is living among them. And you know, the walls and the protection of the walls and all the things that are used, those can apply to heaven. I just think the immediate context is the triumphant church. And what is heaven except the triumphant church? The church who is faithful, the people who make up the church, who remain faithful, live their lives, and die in faith in God, they're the triumphant church. And we've said this back in some of the earlier scenes, with the scenes of the multitude around heaven, gathered around the throne, and waving the palm branches and all that. The immediate context is the church will be victorious over Rome, but that doesn't mean that principle can't be extended to apply to the church, which includes Peter and Paul and drawing a blank. Some of the early church fathers that we've talked about in here, you know, the people who baptized us, if they live there, you know, all of us will be triumphant in heaven, and the scene will be, as much as we can understand, these kind of images, I think, are accurate to that. But I think it also applies to the church that survives Rome, and the church that will endure, because we said last week, why did all this have to play out? Or why did God allow all this to play out? All the way back to the early chapter, chapter 5 or 6, with the fifth seal, and the martyrs were told, wait a little while until all those who must die have died. And we said, why let that happen? And I think the conclusion we came to last week was so that there could be no doubt. God allowed Satan to take his best shot, and the church endured. And in that is a bedrock of faith for us today that the church will endure. If Satan couldn't destroy the church with Rome, he's not going to do it with the United States. He's not going to do it with Islam. He's not going to do it with China. He's not going to do it with any threat that can come against us, because here is a whole book about when Satan took his best shot and God allowed him to take his best shot and failed and ended up in the lake of fire, in contrast to this city and the new heaven and the new earth that are described at the end of the book. Debbie, did you have a comment? Okay. Okay, so the new heaven and the new earth. Even in our notes, in our lesson, a lot of people connect chapter 21, verse 1, and verse 11 of 20, when it says that he who sat upon the throne, from whose presence earth and heaven fled away, and then verse 1 of chapter 21, I saw a new heaven and a new earth. I actually don't connect those two. The premillennialists connect that and say when Jesus comes to sit on his throne here on earth, the old heaven and the old earth are done away with and creates a new heaven and new earth. I think that's a literal translation that's not really indicated here. And I don't even necessarily connect, well, the old earth has passed away, other than it's a new condition. It's a new situation. Because he goes on, I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. There's no longer any sea. He sees the holy city comes down. Verse 3, the tabernacle of God is among men, and he shall dwell among them. God himself shall dwell among them. Verse 4, I think, is the key. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall no longer be any death. There shall no longer be any mourning or crying or pain. The first things have passed away. A phrase that was popular for the paradigm shift. You remember when back a few years ago when everything was about paradigm shift? We use language to describe this. It's a brand new day. You know, we talk about when there's a fundamental change in our city, or it's a whole new world. Is it? Literally, is it a whole new world? No, but my situation has changed. I think that is the better understanding of the new heaven and the new earth. Because what's being described here is this period of conflict, this period of persecution, comes to an end. And when it does, before you had the dragon and the beast and the power that they had and the torment that they were perpetrating upon God's people. And God was allowing it. God's people were suffering. And God's people were dying. And it was being allowed. But now those things have passed away. That has served its purpose. And again, the reason I think that is, where'd it go? Oh, foo, I've lost it. He says it is done.
Verse 6,
yeah, there it is. And he said to me, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. What's done? In this context, the one on the throne says, it is done. What do you think is done?
The victory of the church.
Right. the purpose of the persecution, the purpose that God had in allowing. Does anybody think that Satan was doing anything that God didn't allow with Rome? Has Satan ever done anything that God doesn't allow? You know, that's another popular misconception, is that, you know, Satan and God somehow are equal, and they're equal sides of, opposite sides of. No, I mean, you go back to You go back to Job, and what do you see? Satan before God's throne doing what? Asking permission. What did Jesus say to Peter on the night before his crucifixion? Satan has, actually, I think it says Satan has demanded, but the New American Standard has a footnote that says obtained by asking permission. So even what was going on with Rome, Satan was behind it. And the people who went along with it were responsible for their choices. But Satan wasn't getting one over on God. You know, Satan didn't do an end run around God. It was God's purpose. So I think in this new heaven and new earth, you know, the language, he sees the city coming down from heaven. And again, you know, we kind of shift gears. Oh, it came down from heaven. It's heaven. But elsewhere in the book, we've talked about things coming down from heaven indicate God-sourced, if you will. You know, so we see angels coming out of the temple. And we said, well, if they came out of the temple, that implies what? That they were sent out of the temple. They were directed by God. They were sent from God. And we've seen things come down out of the heavens before. So, you know, this city comes down out of heaven. God approved, God purposed. And then this language here, the voice from the throne, now the tabernacle is among men. Was there ever a time from 95 AD to 250 AD that God wasn't with his people? So what does this mean?
It's just confirmation.
Okay. It's proven. Beyond any shadow of any doubt, the church is victorious over Rome, Satan, through Rome. The church is victorious. These are God's people. All throughout the Old Testament, time and again, we see when the various nations talk about Israel, what do they say about Israel? God is among them. Well, why do they know that? Because every time they went against a faithful Israel, what happened? Yeah, they were beaten back. And the nations around them realized that God is with those people. I think the same idea here in this verse. So I don't make much out of when it says, the tabernacle of God is among men, he shall dwell among them. Like, this is new. This is not new. I mean, God is among us. God is here with us now. God was with them through the persecution. That's kind of the point of the book. I think the idea here is it's proven. It's been tested, and beyond any reasonable doubt, it's been proven that God is with these people. These are God's people because they're triumphant. It's the victorious church. He shall wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall no longer be any death. There shall no longer be any more. We've already seen that language in this book. Do you remember? Was it chapter 7? I think it was talking about the 144,000. Yeah, the 144,000. Verse 15. For this reason they are before the throne of God. They serve him day and night in his temple. He who sits on the throne shall spread his tabernacle over them. Is that not another way of saying dwelling amongst them? They shall hunger no more, neither thirst any more, neither shall the sun beat down on them, nor any heat. So again, it's very tempting. You know, no more death. Oh, that must be eternity. Okay. And that is true. When we get to eternity, there's no more death, good or bad. There's also, if you end up on the wrong side of eternity, there's also no release to look forward to. But here, we said in the previous chapter, death and Hades are cast into the lake of fire, because what was the primary threat that Rome was using to bludgeon Christians into submission? It was the threat of death. That's not a threat anymore. So I think that's part of it. It's just symbolic language portraying a condition of blessedness, of victory, of confidence and encouragement that you've come through. The church has come through this. God's faithful people have come through the worst that Rome could do, and they've come through. And it's victory on the other side. In our lessons, it goes back. Jim points out several places, especially from Isaiah, where this kind of language is used. Both the idea of the new heavens or the first heavens and the first earth being passed away, and we've looked at some of that already. Isaiah 34, I think, is talking about, it's actually the one that I like to go to, because there Isaiah talks about God's judgment on Edom, I think it is, and he says the heavens will be parted like a scroll. Were they? No. Did God judge Edom? Yes. You know, so when people want to get all caught up in the language, so this must be talking about the end. That language has been used in our past, and it didn't mean the end of all things, because we're still here. So you have this idea of the heavens, the first heaven, the first earth being laid bare, and you go back to the Old Testament prophets, and many of the pronouncements of judgments on the rebellious nation, or Judah itself, talks about destroying all things and laying the earth bare and there being no food. But those were not literal descriptions, because the earth is still here today. It's symbolic language to portray God's judgment. And even back in chapter 20, we saw that with the heavens and the earth fleeing from his presence. Likewise, in Isaiah 51, Isaiah 65 and 66, it talks in terms of living long lives. It says an infant born now under these will live to be at least 100. Or maybe I think what it says, if he doesn't live to be 100, his life is considered short. It doesn't mean that everybody lived to be 100. It's just the condition of care and concern. All your needs are met. All your needs, not necessarily your wants, but all your needs are met, and it's language of blessedness. And I think that's consistent with where we are in the book. The devil has been locked away and cast into the lake of fire. The beasts are gone, and now the victorious church appears. And and keep in mind who's speaking here too, describing this. It says in verse 3, a loud voice from the throne. This is not an angel. This is the throne. And I think, by implication, it's the one upon the throne who's saying these things. You know, getting it straight from the source, if you will. These promises, encouragements, descriptions of what the outcome of a faithful life looks like. And to go back to your question, I think that definitely applied to those who lost their lives. I think it applies to those who live. I think it applies just as much to you and I today. So, like so much else of prophecy, even when you go back to the old prophets and you look at things they said that had an immediate context, but looking back on it, you see that there was a larger context. I think you can do that with these. I think the immediate context is the church. If you want to extend that to eternal principles and say this is the outcome for all God, I have no problem with that. I think it's consistent. It's consistent with the rest of Scripture. Yes?
Isaiah 65 and 66, for those not familiar, he uses the
I'm glad you said that. I actually had my pen stuck back in Isaiah to read that exact term is used. Thank you, Gail, because I meant to do that. 65, 17, I think it is, 19. Isaiah 65, 17, for behold, Jehovah says, for behold, I create a new heavens and a new earth, and the former things shall not be remembered or come to mind, but be glad and rejoice forever in what I create. For behold, I create Jerusalem for rejoicing and her people for gladness. And there, God is talking about Judah on the other side of their captivity, of their punishment, when they're restored, when the remnant is restored. But he uses language, create new heaven. Did he? Did he literally create? I mean, was that the end of times? It wasn't. So you see the same kind of language being used here. And we don't have to go to the end of the world to apply these terms. Okay, verse 6, we've talked about it is done. I think, too, and I think this is in Jim's notes as well. You remember way, 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 way back when we started the book, the opening scene that we saw, the one on the throne, and what did he have in his hand? He had the scroll with the seven seals. And we talked about that was, I think, the way I... That was God's plan for all this. That was God's purpose for all this. That was the playing out of everything that's occurred since then. And I think here in verse 6, when he says, it is done, I think he's talking about that scroll has been complete. All the seals have been broken. All the trumpets have been sounded. All the bowls have been poured out. This thing has played out to its conclusion. And the conclusion is the triumphant church. If you go back a few chapters where the seventh seal is broken, actually when the seventh seal is broken, it is proclaimed, it is done. So this was all deliberate, I guess, for lack of a better word. Like I said, Rome didn't do anything God didn't expect or allow. Satan didn't do anything. Satan didn't come up with a stratagem that God wasn't expecting with Rome. God allowed this to play out to make a point to, I think, number one, to his people. Number one, to his people at the time. Number two, to his people throughout the ages. And number three, to the world. Like I said, you go back to the Old Testament, and with the parting of the Red Sea and the sun standing still, and you know the battles that shouldn't have been won that were won, Gideon, Sennacherib, and the 85,000, all those things that God did, the message to the nations was what? God is with these people. He is God. He is the God, and these are his people. And I think the Roman persecution had the same intent and purpose. You read this book, you go back and you read history, you see how all that played out. You cannot walk away from it if you're being honest in your evaluation of the evidence. You cannot walk away from that thinking anything else than God is with his people. And no matter what the world, what Satan throws at it, his people will come through it victorious. It may not look like victory to the world, but in the, to use one of my former elders, the real reality, which is the reality that Christians live in, the reality of faith, in the real reality, the church always wins, despite what it looks like. And that's a message, and that's images that have been portrayed over and over and over in this book. You know, we talked about a call to faithfulness, encouragement to faithfulness. Verse 7, he who overcomes shall inherit these things, and I will be his God, and he will be my son. You know, I mean, you don't get more intimate with God than to be his child. Yeah, and that's what's being, not he can come serve me, not he can come and, you know, I'll assign him a rank down, I'll give him a job, you know, sweeping the golden streets of Jerusalem. Be his son in his household, intimate with God. You know, so that, and again, that goes back to the beginning of the book. I think a lot from here onward, there's a lot of kind of tying back to, it's bringing everything, bookending everything into, this started with encouragement and a call to faithfulness, and the book ends with encouragement and a call to faithfulness. And in those epistles, over and over and over, what did it say? To him who overcomes, this will be given. To him who overcomes, this will be given. And that's a encouragement and a call to be faithful in the face of the persecution that's coming. That's how the book started. Now here at the end of the book, the same things are being said. I've kept saying that Revelation keeps presenting a contrast, an either or. To him who overcomes, you get to be a son in God's household. But for the cowardly and the unbelieving and the abominable murderers and immoral persons and sorcerers, idolaters and liars, their part will be where? Lake of fire. And where? Who else is in that lake of fire already? Yeah. Now, what's interesting to me, and you can tell me if you think this is a reach or not, up to this point, we've already kind of dealt with all the followers of the devil and everything, and that we all know they're in the lake of fire. Here, do you think that what's being contrasted here is not those who are members of God's church and those who were Roman sympathizers, Roman allies? Or is it those who were members of God's church who were steadfast and faithful and those who turned away under the pressure of persecution? And that's exactly what I wonder about this, because we've already kind of dealt with those who followed the beast. They're already in the lake of fire. Now here's another group that's being described as being cast into the lake of fire. And I wonder, because I said earlier, one thing that's very clear here is there's no middle ground. You don't get to say, well, I'm with the lamb, but I'll do this for the beast, but then I'm with the lamb, but I'll do that. I mean, that's never been the service that God accepts. So, just like Denise said, if you claim to be a Christian, but yeah, you know, I'll throw a pinch of incense, and it doesn't mean anything because I know who the true God is, but you know, I'll just throw a little pinch of incense, and it's just a little thing. How is that person any different than the people who just wholeheartedly take the mark of the beast and say, yes, I'm allied with the beast? I wonder if what's being said here is there's not any difference. Well, and to that point, look at this list. Murderers and liars. Okay, now who do we know outside the church? Who do we know in the world that would put a murderer and a liar on the same level?
Nobody.
But that's not how God sees sin. That's not how God sees unfaithfulness. Just like Denise said, there's no such thing as a little bit of unfaithfulness in God's eye. You're either for me or you're against me. And against me covers a whole spectrum from murderers to liars. But I think the way it starts out talking about the cowardly and the unbelieving is what kind of tilts me toward that viewpoint, that this might be being addressed to Christians who are wavering, who are thinking, well, I could just not say this or just toss that little pinch in, and it would just, then I would still be here to be able to teach people God. You know, there's all kinds of rationalizations that we come up with for going along with the work, when really what we're doing is we're just trying to make things easier for ourselves. Yeah, and that's a good point. You start off by just tossing a pinch of incense, but one thing that's very clear elsewhere in Scripture is that sin is a progression. You don't ever just do a little sin and kind of stay there. Sin is deceitful, and sinners are described as going from bad to worse. Yeah, and see that's why I think it's talking about a subset. Up till now, it's been God's people versus Rome's people, but now this seems to me like it's addressed to God's people, and it's a caution to be faithful. That if you overcome, well, you're not going to overcome if you're cowardly and unbelieving, and you give a little to get a little and get along. But if you overcome your son, but if you have a coward's heart, then it's the lake of fire. So, I mean, that's how that verse strikes me, because it seems a little redundant, because we've already talked about Rome's allies being cast into the lake of fire. So if this is just Rome's allies again, I mean, maybe so, but it just, the language seems to slant a little more toward a caution to those who claim to be followers of Lamb to go through with the following him wherever he goes, whatever it leads us into. Okay. So the scene then shifts, and it's mentioned briefly in verse 2, the holy city. And then in verse 9, again, one of the seven angels, and we've talked about them, one of the seven that poured out the bowls, and they were wearing the white raiment and the golden girdle, and their raiment is actually described in similar terms as Jesus himself. So a very high-ranking angel now takes John. And this is the same angel who showed John the woman on the beast, the scarlet woman, and her fate. So now he takes John, and John sees this vision of the city. This is where a lot of our songs come from. And, you know, okay, who here has heard about Heaven's Pearly Gates? Yeah. Now, what do you usually see? If you see, like, artwork, what do you usually see when they say Heaven's Pearly Gates? How do they usually depict those? Yeah, it's. I mean, usually what I think of are the barred gates that swing inward, you know, and they're made out of pearl, and they've got scroll work, and the little lectern is over here with St. Peter, you know. That's what a lot of people think. They talk about the pearly gates. What's actually described here are massive pearls, like a round gate with a massive pearl, because it says it's a single pearl. I only point that out to say how off. So much. What people will swear up and down, the Bible says this. And you go and read it, and it doesn't say that at all. And it's just how all, and so much of the imagery here about New Jerusalem, this New Jerusalem that John has shown, is taken to, you know, by people who are not really that careful about what the Bible actually says. And they say, oh, well, you know, and they do their art and they show their pictures and they make their descriptions, and it's not based on what the actual text says. So the way this city is described, just a couple of notes, and I don't get too caught up in the like the different gems in the foundation. You know, first of all, I don't know anybody that claims that they know absolutely what the significance of all these gems are. And I don't think that's the point. If I said, hey, if you'll get up at 3 a.m. and come with me, I know where there's a chest full of treasure. And man, it's full of gold and rubies and emeralds and diamonds. And do you need to know what the significance of the rubies and the emeralds and the diamond are? I mean, do you need to know what that? Or is it just enough to know that it's treasure, that it's highly desired, that it's precious? You know, I think that's kind of the idea here of the jeweled foundations. I don't get too caught up in trying to assign a significance to each one of these gemstones. But look at some of the things that are said about this city. Gotten behind on my notes. It says, first of all, it's on a great and high mountain. Where else have we seen a great and high mountain in Revelation? Remember the 144,000? Where are they? They were on top of a mountain with the Lamb. So I think it's the idea of ascendancy. You know, they've reached the top. We use that expression, right? You know, it means we won. We've reached the top. So this city is up on this high mountain. And this holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. I don't think that means that this was in heaven came, other than victory from the church. Victory for the church is going to come from where? The church? Its members? A sympathetic government?
It's always going to be God.
And our ability to be victorious comes from God. Our ability to be redeemed, our ability to receive this comfort, all comes from God. None of it comes from us. You can go back to Daniel's prayer in chapter 9 when he's praying for God's help, and he says, not for any merit of ours, but because you are who you are. So, you know, this city, this victorious place that I think the first century church ends up in, but by extension, we all end up in. If you want to extend that to heaven, I don't think that's unreasonable. This place that we end up with is God approved. God caused. It came from heaven. It couldn't come from anywhere else. Having the glory of God, brilliance like a very costly stone, a stone as crystal clear as jasper. You know, the idea of light and glory. You know, as opposed to what?
Darkness.
Darkness. And those are images that are used time and again in the New Testament. It had a great and high wall with 12 gates, and at the gates 12 angels. I've always wondered, do you think that's one angel at each gate, or each gate had 12 angels?
Well,
I mean, the language is a little unclear. Either way, who's getting through that gate?
Only the believers.
Only the ones that the angels allow, mm-hmm. Right? I mean, how many angels did God assign to Eden to keep man out of Eden? It was one cherubim. And here, whether it's 12 or 144, the idea is massive walls, gates with angels guarding the gates. It's the idea of safety and security. The only ones that are getting through those gates are the ones who God's angels will allow through the gate. Now remember, the scenes all before have been, well, the dragon's going to do this, and the beasts are going to do this, and you know the saints are going to be subjected to this, and the two witnesses were killed by the beast. But now there's these massive walls, and there's these gates, and the gates are guarded by angels. The names were written on the gates, those of the 12 tribes of the sons of Israel. We've talked about this with the 104. What do the 12 tribes represent? In the book of Revelation, the 12 tribes?
It's God's people.
Right. So it's kind of like, you know, if you're walking through the woods and you come up on a little clubhouse and it has a sign on the top of it that says, boys club only. Who's in that club?
Boys only.
So on these gates, it's got the names of the 12 tribes. If that represents God, who's in that city? Whose city is that? It's God's people. The world, the beasts, have no part in this. This is God's people, surrounded by these walls and guarded by these angels. Three gates on each side. Jim in his notes mentioned, if you go back and read Exodus, when they set up the tabernacle, the tribes would camp three to a side. And the idea was that the tabernacle was in the middle, or the midst of Israel. God in the center. I don't know. I mean, okay, that there's a connection there. I don't know if that's exactly the thought, but gates on three sides, you know, if you have God's people on all sides, I think another idea or another way to look at that is this city is accessible from all directions. And not just one gate. All directions are equal. The universality of the church, that men, God's people, can enter from the north, from the south, from the east. There's not a exclusion. There's not a direction that only gets one gate in this city. It's equally accessible from all sides. The 12 foundation stones, on them were the 12 names of the 12 apostles. That's familiar language. Was it Paul that talked about the, was it, Gail, was it Ephesians that Paul talks about? Built on the apostles and prophets. Yeah, and Christ is the chief cornerstone. That's what I was thinking. So, you know, so a structure is only as good as its foundation. You know, Jesus told a parable about that, about building a house on sandbars. But this is built on what? The work of the apostles. And to Christians who understand, especially Christians, some of whom were still alive but knew the apostles when this book was written, or at least maybe their parents had known the apostles and seen the apostles and seen the work that the apostles did. And this city is built on that. And in reality, from Jesus' conversation with Peter, the church was built on the fact that Jesus was who he said he was. He was God's son. But I think it's the idea of the strength of this edifice that's built here, being described here. The city is laid out square, verse 16, and its length is great as the width. 1,500 miles. You try to picture that, because what's being described here is a cube. 1,500 miles wide, 1,500 miles long, and 1,500 miles high. You know, the symmetry of it, again, equally accessible. You approach that cube from any direction, and you see the same amount of square footage. Also, I think Jim in his notes points out the stability. You know, a cube that's as wide as it is broad is hard to move or tip, as opposed to, you know, something that has asymmetric dimensions.
I also see very grand and substantial and well-planned
design. Design, yeah. Cubes don't happen in nature generally.
It just reminds me of the Holy of Holies.
Okay. I hadn't thought about that, but you're exactly right. The Holy of Holies, or the Holiest of Holies, was a cube as well. I had missed that completely. And the idea of 1,500 miles. I mean, I don't know how big New York City is, but it's not 1,500 miles. Or London. London's a big place, but it's not 1,500 miles. I mean, this is a structure that man can't build. We don't have the technology to build something 1,500 miles tall. I mean, you know, we built some pretty tall buildings, but nothing. I mean, maybe 1,500 feet. I don't even know if there's anything that tall. But, you know, this is just something that is completely beyond man. Rachel, and then.
That's what I was going to comment on, is the size. You know, like, you can fit everybody that wants to go, right?
Yeah.
Room for everybody.
That's a good point, too. Yes, I agree completely.
Carl.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes.
Do you think that the imagery?
Right. No, yes, I think these are images are trying to get us as close as we can come within our limitations to under. But now, Shannon, go ahead and make your comment on this. And I'm glad you pointed that out, and thank you for that. The 12. We've noted before, 12 tribes, 12 apostles, 144,000 is 12 by 12. 12 is used in Revelation to represent God's people. This is 12 by 12 by 12. all of God's people. Actually, it's 12,000. So there's that 1,000 too. So it's, you know, it's the idea, to Rachel's point, all of God's people are represented by the city. And what is the city? It's safe. It's secure. It's precious. You know, the foundations. And usually, you know, a building, the foundation is usually not the part you pretty up, right? Because it's down the basement. But this city is so glorious that even its very foundations are built of all these precious materials. And again, it's very tempting. And it's, you start talking about it and you start kind of looking toward heaven. And all the things that have been said are true of heaven. But I like Jim's comment here in at the end of this lesson, point five. He says, God's city, this city that's being described, his people, excels anything man can conceive or execute. So that's what his church is. And if it is that far beyond man, what does his church have ever to fear from anything man can do? You know, it kind of goes back to Romans 8. If God is for us, who can be against us? So I think that's the idea of this imagery here, is this is what the church is going to look like when Rome is done. Now, when this book was written, when people first read it, it may have looked like they were headed for a different outcome. But here at the end of the book, there's this portrayal of this edifice that just boggles the human imagination. It's kind of like when you go back to Ezekiel and you try to figure out God's throne from the... And it's hard to grasp, because I think it is. It's God using language that can get us as close as we're able to comprehend to the eternal truths that only he knows. So that's kind of, it's the end game. This is all going to play out, the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, you know, start to finish, I think is the idea. God, this is God's all the way. But when it plays out, John is being shown this structure that is just beyond anything. I mean, you think about what Rome, I don't know how big the Colosseum is, but it would have been probably hard to see sitting next to this city that John has shown. Okay, our time is gone. Gail, did you have anything you wanted to... And you said that was from Ezekiel, or Zechariah, right? So after the restoration, after the captivity has been endured, when it looked like God's plan might have been derailed, they're back, and then he's looking ahead to the ultimate fulfillment with the Messiah. And I was struck as you were reading that, the similarity in the language between the God's victorious purpose in... All right, well, thank you so much for your comments. We will conclude our study with Revelation with chapter 22 next week.